Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded December 20th, 2010, episode 47, audio legend Dan D'Agostino. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off the lifetime of your new account, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code HTG. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. This week's guest geek is Dan D'Agostino, co-founder of Krell and a legendary amplifier designer. Hey Dan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Scott. Nice to be here.
I'm really happy to have you on. I've heard your name for many, many years, and we're going to talk about your illustrious career as an amplifier designer. Before we do, I want to make sure that those who are tuned in to the live video stream at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Dan, and I'll pass on as many as I can. So, Dan, let's start with how you got started. How did you get started in audio electronics?
Well, I guess it's a combination of my love for music, and I guess my dad was really into music and got the hi-fi bug back when I was 11 or 12 years old. Mm. So at that time, I really got exposed to the beginnings of hi-fi.
What kind of equipment did he have in the house that you got exposed to?
Well, he started off reading this article in Wireless World about a clip horn. And he decided that he was going to build one. So he did.
He built his own Klipshorn speaker.
Right. I mean, there was a big article on how to do it. You could buy the drivers from Klipsch, and as I recall, I guess that's what he did. And he put it together, and he didn't have a decent amplifier, so he went out and bought a Dynaco. I forgot the model number. And proceeded to play around with that and make sound with it. And the Klipshorn was huge. I mean, my mother or grandmother lived at my grandparents, and neither one of them really wanted it in the house, especially with raw plywood.
Right.
So.
Yeah, the Dynaco was probably a do-it-yourself, or did it come pre-built?
It was a do-it-yourself. So he got me started on that, and he wasn't actually very good. You know, he's dead now, so God rest his soul. He wasn't very good with reading the instructions or soldering. And I wasn't either. I was just a novice. I was a kid, so I started to play around with it and learned how to do it. And I was in an electric shop. You know, I had my seventh grade teacher, an electric shop, show me how to solder. And he taught me some stuff and answered some questions for me. And I put the kit together with him. But I did most of the reading and the hooking up of the parts and soldering because he was very clumsy at it.
Mm. And so, did that experience get you jazzed about designing?
It didn't get me jazzed about designing. What it got me jazzed about is to make something that made sound. And I never thought about being an engineer. It was not something I was thinking about at that age. In fact, I was hoping I could get out of school early.
As most of us were, I'm sure.
Yeah. So what was thrilling about it is putting the whole thing together and turning it on at the end, and it actually worked. That was something that was thrilling.
Yes.
And I think that really formed my brain about doing that kind of stuff where you do something and you get a positive results.
Right, exactly. So then fast forward to, I believe it was 1980 or so, and you co-founded Krell?
Yeah, you know, I had worked for, in different parts of the industry. I'd worked for Gale loudspeakers from England. And I work for an obscure little company called Great White Whale, which was into distribution and work with designing some speakers with them. And right after that, I was watching the marketplace, and, you know, there was this big fallout in 1979 where a bunch of manufacturers went out of business. And a lot of amplifier manufacturers, and two or three of them here in Connecticut. So I looked around the industry and saw that there was a lot of hoopla about the Mark Levinson number. I think it was number 20. ML2. I'm sorry, was a 25 watt Class A amplifier, and everybody said, "Wow, it's great, but it's only 25 watts." And I said, you know, I don't know why you can't build a 100 watt Class A amplifier. It seemed to me that there's no reason why you can't do it. So I started working on that because I thought that there would be a big hole in the industry for that kind of product because no one had ever made anything with that kind of power in Class A before.
Was this a tube-based amp that you're talking about?
No, this is a solid-state amp.
Solid-state amp, okay.
Yeah. So I'm working on this solid-state amp, and I got it working, and I had met Rondi at a consumer show, and she was working at the time for Mitchell A. Cotter. And I told her, we started talking about the industry, and she was telling me how wonderful the Cotter stuff was and wish she had an amplifier. And we talked about an amplifier, and I said, well, I have an amplifier that I designed, and maybe you'd like to listen to it, you know. So we were in different parts of the country at the time, and I drove the product out to a friend of hers who was a reviewer. And we hooked it up, and we played it, and it turned out to be, everybody really liked the sound of it. And I knew it was really good because the stuff that I had that I compared it to at the time, it was way better than.
Mm.
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, one of the things that I have always wanted to ask you, and now I have the chance, the name of the company, Krell, we're just about to the point where that got founded, but I have to ask, is it true? Is the rumor true that the name of the company came from the movie Forbidden Planet?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It definitely came from Forbidden Planet.
Okay, we remember. Anybody who saw that movie knows the reference. The Krell were the long gone aliens on the planet, which the technology had been discovered by Morbius, and ultimately led to his demise. But I always thought that was great. And why did that name get chosen as the name of this company?
Well, we couldn't think of a name. You know, we both decided we wanted to do this together. She was a little tired of her job, and I really didn't have a job at the point, that moment. I had left Gale, and I was doing my own thing. And so I decided that I was going to make this amplifier. She wanted to be involved with it. And so we, two of us got together and said, we'll start this company. And so what are we going to call it? I mean, her last name was Holling. My last name was D'Agostino, and we didn't want to do anything like that. I didn't want to lend my name to it at the time. And I said that we need to have something that says power. And we were laughing and talking about different names. And somehow, I can't remember exactly how we got on the name of science fiction stuff. And we start talking about movies. And I said, what about calling it Krell, like the Krell people who had unlimited power?
Yes,
and we kind of laughed. But I said, "Why not?" You know, it's kind of an interesting name, and it has some heritage in the sci-fi industry of making a product that has unlimited power. So in fact, the amplifier kind of led us to it because when you compared it to other amplifiers with more power, at least in watts, when you hooked it up to a loudspeaker, the amplifier that I had designed seemed to have way more power than any of those. And so we kind of got this idea that the amplifier had this unlimited kind of power feeling. So that's when we latched on to the name Krell. It made perfect sense.
It does make perfect sense, actually. And it's brilliant and a very recognizable and memorable. So I think you guys did a great job on that. I wanted to ask you about that power amp. First of all, for our listeners and viewers, let's define Class A. You use that term, and I want to make sure that we are all on the same page with what that means. Can you give us a brief definition of that?
Well, basically you're designing an amplifier with zero notch distortion because the amplifier is constantly working in a Class A mode.
So am I not correct that means that as the voltage swings from positive to negative and through zero and back and forth and back and forth as the audio signal, the same set of output devices, in this case transistors, are amplifying the entire signal, as opposed to Class AB, where the top half is being amplified by one set, and the positive half, I should say, and the negative half by another set. Have I got that right?
Well, no, actually, it was a complementary amplifier, so it didn't use a single type of transistor. And what I did was I basically just kept on adding bias to it so that when the amplifier clipped, the current and the voltage clipped at exactly the same time.
Ah, so and that, the advantage so that, of that so is?
The advantage of that is you're operating in pure Class A. There's no notch, and the crossover point is non-existent. It's the same signal. It's continuous,
as opposed to not being continuous in the case of Class B or Class AB, right?
Yeah, Class AB, there's definitely a notch, and discernible over a certain power range.
Right. The other question I wanted to ask you was regarding what you've said so far. This amplifier that you took a look at and said, oh, I could do more power than that, was 25 watts. And yet, isn't it true that in most cases, under most listening conditions, you're not using very many watts, really? The speaker is responding to the first few watts. And rarely do you ever really get into the 50, 100, 200 watt usage. Am I right about that?
Well, I can't say that you are. I mean, you can go back as far as maybe 20 some years ago. Julian Hirsch had written an article about how much power it takes to play a piano through an average set of loudspeakers. And it turned out that it was thousands of watts to produce it at even reasonable listening levels.
That must have been a very inefficient speaker then.
Well, I think it was a speaker that was, for the time, was probably 86 or 87 dBs for 1 watt in. But on the other hand, I think when you look at the broad spectrum of music and all of the peaks and harmonics that happen with a chord or a drum beat, I mean, it goes on for infinity. I mean, and it does take a fair amount of power to follow it. I mean, and nowadays, commonplace speaker is 90 dB sufficient for 1 watt in, which helps. But the fact is that when you start turning the volume up and you get complex musical crescendos, I think you find that a lot of power is consumed. I mean, it's been my experience at Crow. The bigger we made the amplifier, and all things being equal, it sounded better. And the music sounded more musical and bigger.
I've always believed that with a lot of power, you end up having a lot of headroom, and the amp is operating more in its linear range. It's not having to work as hard. Is that a consideration?
It's a consideration for certain types of designs. I mean, I've always designed amplifiers with a lot of current running through the driver stage. I mean, a lot of current, so that when the amplifier is operating at very low levels, it's extremely linear, and at high levels, it's also extremely linear. Designing a small amplifier is easy. Designing a very big amplifier that has very musical is very difficult.
We've got a question in the chat room that's somewhat peripheral but interesting. Years ago, I interviewed the romance novel cover boy Fabio. And he turned out to be a strong Krell user, along with Martin Logan speakers. Did you ever have any contact with him?
Well, actually, it turns out that when he was living in New York, he had gone into a hi-fi store. I don't remember which one it was, but he had heard my product there and decided he wanted to buy it. And when he found out that the company was in Connecticut, he called me and wanted to come up and visit, and I didn't know Fabio from anybody at the time, and this must have been in 1983 or 84, and he took a limousine from New York and came up to the factory and met, and I didn't know what to expect, but he and I turned out to be very close friends. He's always been a really great guy and a great supporter and really loves music. And he loves big equipment. You know, he's kind of a big guy. He lives a real, male oriented, big cars, big audio equipment, kind of life.
Yeah. I actually, when I interviewed him, I actually went to his house in Los Angeles, and he told me that for exercise, he moves his equipment around by hand. I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Well, now, you were the chief engineer at Krell for 30 years.
Yeah.
And I'd like to know how your approach to amplifier design has changed over that period of time.
Well, I think as we progressed over the 30 years, the amplifiers got more complex. And the complexity had to do with the amount of power we were trying to achieve. I mean, we did, in fact, build some very big Class A amplifiers. I think that as we approached over a period of years, the amplifiers did get more complicated, more parts intensive, bigger power supplies, different technologies that we brought into play. I mean, at Krell, we always pushed for the leading edge of audio. We did all of our own work. We didn't use anything that anybody else had done. We didn't use op amps, and we tried to do everything original, because it's always been my feeling that when you do an amplifier and you put your name on it, that it should be something that you actually did.
Sure, absolutely. So it got, the amps got more complicated, more parts in there. Why did they become more complicated? What was the advantage of adding these parts and these complexities into the system? Well, did it end up just sounding better or more reliable, or what was the purpose?
Well, the whole purpose is to make something that sounds really good. And as you make bigger and bigger power amplifiers, I mean, we were making routinely 700, 800, 900 watt amplifiers that operated in Class A mode using our patent, the sustained plateau biasing. And these amplifiers, in order to sound musical, took a lot of extra circuitry and a lot of extra care and a lot of engineering to make them do what they did.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain that? What did you call it? Sustained plateau bias?
Right. Because, if you study back at the time, I mean, there's been a few amplifiers out there, particularly in the early 70s, middle 70s, that had sliding bias. And I think Threshold, patented a sliding bias. People called it a sliding bias because it followed the audio signal, and the bias followed the audio signal and kept the amplifier in Class A. And I guess if you wanted to criticize that, which I really don't want to, but I'm basically saying the caveat to that design is that the bias is changing at an audio rate and is causing distortion in the output devices because they're operating nonlinear in the bias mode. Mm. And if you look at that, how do you prevent that? And what I thought about was that we had like a anticipator that looked at the signal coming in and ramped the bias up to the signal, much like a sliding bias amp. But then it didn't stop. It would actually hold that amount of bias. So if you had a signal come in and you needed, let's say, 2 amps to hold the amplifier in Class A, for that signal, the amplifier would stay at 2 amps for 90 seconds, even though the music was no longer needed. And if it went higher, it would ramp it up to higher current. So it held it in Class A, so you didn't have nonlinear distortions at the output stage. So, in fact, you did get something that resembled pure Class A operation, and it sounded really excellent, and you were able to build some monster Class A amplifiers that didn't, continuously use a huge amount of energy. I mean, if you're playing something that only needs, and you talked about this earlier, only in a different area, if you're playing something that only needs 50 watts of Class A to play it, why do you need to have it biased at 900? So that's what this circuit did, and the sustaining of the bias threshold reduces the distortion in the output stage like it's supposed to when you don't have the output stage being bias being jacked up and down at an audio rate.
Mm-hmm. We have a question in the chat room. How have simulation and measurement methods changed in the design of your amplifiers over the years?
Well, they haven't changed a whole lot. I mean, I guess the measurement devices, you know, Audio Precision made a huge change in how we measured amplifiers. And, you know, we were able to get down into lower distortion ratings and look more at more complex waveforms with the new test equipment that's available now. I don't think that you know, an audio amplifier is still an audio amplifier. It hasn't changed. I think that you know, just comparing the input to the output and making sure the amplifier behaves in a linear fashion, regardless of what the load is on it, is the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. What about measuring power output? Certainly, there's been a lot written about how manufacturers measure power output in one way or another in order to maximize that number on a spec sheet. What's your feeling about power measurement, and does it really mean anything in terms of shopping for an amp?
Well, I think if you're honest about it, I mean, true RMS power is a standard that I always use, and I'm always into making amplifiers that have that become voltage sources. That is, that if they're 100 watts at 8 ohms, you know, they're 200 watts at 4, they're 400 watts at 2, mm-hmm. and they'd be 800 watts at 1, and they become a voltage source, so that regardless of the speaker load, the amplifier's output voltage remains the same. And right. And I think that's very, very important, because even the most sophisticated speakers have impedance variations. And some of the ones I've recently looked at, some of them have a nominal 4 or 5 ohm load, but then sometimes they go down to 1 ohm, and sometimes they go down below that.
Wow. And that's frequency dependent. It is certain frequencies.
Exactly. Yeah,
the impedance will drop down, and then other frequencies it'll go back up.
Exactly. So, I mean, if the amplifier is trying to drive the loudspeaker, if the power supply can't keep up with the load, or the output stage is not capable of playing that low impedance dip, what happens to the amplifier then? I mean, the thing you have to think about in the output of the amplifier is if it's trying to play a 1 ohm load and it can't, or a 2 ohm load and it runs out of power, then the output devices are starving for power, and then they snap back as the impedance goes up. I mean, I think that's not a good thing. I mean, that's kind of like the speaker playing the amplifier as opposed to the amplifier playing the speaker.
Very good point. So really, the amplifier designer's job is to make sure that doesn't happen if they want an amplifier that can be used with virtually any speaker.
Yes. I mean, I'm not saying that every amplifier has to drive a 1 ohm load. I mean, there's very good amplifiers that drive, you know, 8 and 4 ohms very, very linearly, and then they below that, they start to their output starts to reduce. Mm-hmm. But I mean, for me, most amplifiers that I design, I like to see them go down to 2 ohms, and I like to see them have lower distortion than 0.1 ohm, I mean 0.1%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would really, I think they should have 0.05% at full power at low impedances. And not that distortion is an end all or be all, but I believe that, I mean, first of all, you can make an amplifier that's 150 watts at 0.05% be almost 200 watts at 1%. So where do you draw the line?
Yeah, exactly. And I've certainly seen plenty of amps that even in our testing labs measure at 0.1 or greater percent that are still, you know, considered to be very good sounding amps. Where do you draw the line is a very good and not easily answered question.
No, it isn't. And the distortion is such a, it's a rule. It's just a measurement, like a slide rule measurement. It doesn't in most cases have very much to do with sound.
Mm.
I mean, I believe that the amplifier is working correctly and the distortion is reasonable. I don't think you'll actually hear 1% distortion.
Right.
I mean,
exactly
unless it's the type that's really annoying. I mean, I think that most good amplifier designers are not so concerned with distortion as they are with linear power out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another question in the chat room asks, do you think the quality of the electricity being supplied to the amp makes a difference to the sound?
You know, I've been back and forth with this, and I've really tried to hear power conditioners and different things that have been touted as making the amplifiers sound better. But I don't know. I think that in amplifiers that I have designed and been involved with, we've always made our power supplies really rigid and robust, and the transformers that we're using are way over spec'd in the primary, so that they don't saturate easily by complex waveforms coming out of the wall. So right. I believe that if you have a really good power supply, that those kind of devices are going to make very little difference for you. And if you have conversely a marginal power supply, maybe a power conditioner is going to make a big difference in how it sounds.
Mm-hmm. Before we get going, before we continue here, I just would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. Squarespace.com has an easy-to-use user interface for creating and managing your website or blog, and it's optimized for both beginners and CSS experts. Hundreds of design templates are available, and you can customize any of them to fit your needs. The all-inclusive service includes several modules to build your website, such as a blog module, a forum, form builder, Flickr photo display, Twitter widget, everybody needs that, of course, Google Maps, and more. Website tracking and built-in search engine optimizer certainly help people find your website. You have permission access handling, cloud architecture for speed and site stability, an innovative drag-and-drop AJAX interface, even an iPhone app so you can log into your website and update it from wherever you are. Use Squarespace for all your website needs. Build it, host it, update it anytime. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com and sign up for a free account. There's no credit card needed. Just try it out to build your own website. Then if you decide to purchase, use the offer code HTG and get 10% off the lifetime of your new account. That's squarespace.com and use the offer code HTG. So, Dan, you sold Krell in 2009 and started a new company under your own name. What led you to do that?
Well, I should say I really didn't sell Krell. I took in an investor, and they essentially decided they didn't need me there. And they through what I consider to be a poor contract, I got thrown out of my own company.
Oh, no. Oh, yep. Man. Well, that sucks.
Yeah, it does. But, I'm having a lot of fun doing this.
Now, so you started your own company under your own name. It's Dan D'Agostino, Inc.
Exactly.
So you're not done yet. You have more things to say about power amps, right?
Well, I think I do. I think I have a real winner. I think I have a real good idea about where audio amplifiers are going. And I think that the amplifier that we have that we're going to introduce here this month is really extraordinary sounding. In fact, I think it's the best amplifier I've ever been involved with.
It's called the Momentum, and I've actually profiled it. I've written a descriptive profile on ultimateavmag.com. Beautiful looking amp. How did you come up with the industrial design?
You know, I just I can't. You know, I was kind of doodling. I'm trying to build an amplifier in a smaller stature. Kind of start doodling with it and kind of molded it into my brain, and pretty soon I kind of had the basic look, and then I refined it and got what I have, which I think is an extraordinary looking product. It also is the first time somebody's using large amounts of copper for cooling.
Yes, I was going to bring this up. Instead of a heat sink with fins, as most power amps have, you've gone, and they're aluminum, by the way, you've gone with copper and what are called Venturi tubes instead of fins, which actually draw air through them by convection and cool the amp that way. How'd you come up with that idea?
Well, I guess I was talking with a friend of mine that's a guy that works at a military company, and we started talking about thermal techniques, and this is certainly one of them. I'm not the first person to use round holes through a heatsink. I think there's another couple other companies that have done it before I did. But what I thought about too is I wanted to use the copper, and I wanted to use a venturi, which kind of amplifies the airflow going through it.
Mm-hmm. And copper, I believe, has a greater thermal conductivity than aluminum, even, right?
Oh, yeah, well, copper, you know, aluminum has got some great properties, and copper has some great properties. Neither one of them are perfect for moving heat. The difference between copper and aluminum is copper conducts heat 91% faster than aluminum. So when your output devices get hot, it takes the heat away from them right away.
Right.
Now, aluminum takes longer to get hot because it takes longer to absorb the heat, but it also releases heat faster than copper. So you have aluminum does some things a little bit better than copper, and copper does some things a lot better than aluminum, but neither one of them are perfect. The copper happens to work extremely well for an audio amplifier because it does take the heat away from the power transistors at an amazingly fast rate.
Mm. And those power transistors, you're still in Class A, right, in this amp?
No, we're using, this is a Class AB amp.
Oh, okay.
I didn't want to make a Class A amp. I've done that. I've been there. I wanted to make something that really sounds excellent, does not use a ton of power, and is green. And this amplifier is green when it's off. It only draws less than a watt.
In fact, this was one question in the chat room, which is, how do you feel about this new tendency towards green and power consumption and so on? And clearly this amp addresses that very concern.
I'm very concerned about it because I have to say that, I happen to have a really big living room, but I've been over a friend's house that have my equipment that have had the equipment that I've made, and my amplifiers have heated their house up and some of my other houses that I've lived in unmercifully. I mean, in the summertime, you running an air conditioner to keep the amplifiers cool. I mean, it's really an amazing thing. I mean, it's great to talk about it, but when you live with it over and over again, I think it's time that we make amplifiers that don't run as hot.
Mm. And so this amp is designed to do exactly that, as well as drawing less power, particularly when idle. You say it only draws a trickle of power. Now, are Class AB amps more efficient in their use of power from the wall than Class A?
Yes, because they're not draining the wall all the time. The Class A amplifier has a certain amount of current that is drawing from the wall, regardless of whether you're using it or not.
I see.
Where a Class AB amp, as you increase the power out of it by raising the volume up, it uses more power. When you're not, it uses less.
Gotcha. Got a question from the chat room. Can you reveal some of the innovations in this amplifier, this new Momentum amplifier? And F-Loop says, the more technical, the better. Now, obviously, you're not going to reveal any trade secrets or anything, but... have we covered that already, or is there something more can say?
No, I mean, basically, the amplifier is all discrete. It uses no op amps. It doesn't use any digital circuitry in it and of any kind. There's no microcontrollers or any clocks running in the amplifier. It's all discrete parts. We don't use any surface mount because over my years of using surface mount, I found that it's not robust enough to give you real longevity in an amplifier design.
Mm-hmm.
I think that through-hole components are much more robust. I think they sound better because you use less of them to do the same thing. I think that on this amplifier, I explored some things that I always wanted to do with the type of circuitry I've used in the past. And I had a great departure from a lot of the stuff that I had done at Krell with it. And I kept on modeling this amplifier into almost a perfect amplifying device with the minimal amount of gain stages and a maximum amount of low distortion circuitry that doesn't need feedback to correct. It's got very low feedback, probably 8-9 dBs of feedback.
Mm.
So it's got reasonably low distortion. It's in the 0.05, 0.06%. And it has very little feedback, It uses a very unique circuit that I'm not willing to talk about too much right now because I'm trying to get a patent pending on it. But I haven't really got there yet. But I'm working on it with my lawyer, so hopefully I'll have one.
Very good. This almost sounds like a return to the simple design. You were talking earlier about how at Krell and over the 30 years that you worked there, amps got more complex with more devices in them and so on and so forth. And now it almost sounds like you're returning back to a more simple time.
Well, it's simpler in the fact that there's no microcontrollers in it. It doesn't have auto biasing. It's got a normal bias circuit. But I think as far as the audio circuitry goes, it's got a lot of parts and it's somewhat complicated.
Still, it's in a relatively small package.
It's in a very small package, which has been a nightmare for me. I'm used to working in much bigger packages.
Right.
And to build this amplifier in this little package and get the kind of power out that I'm looking for was really amazingly hard to do. I mean, I didn't realize how much effort was going to be put in to get it to do what it did, what it's doing.
One other question in the chat room. What is your feeling about Class D amplifiers?
I'm not a big fan. I'm not
Why is
a big
that?
Fan. Well, first of all, I've never heard one that I really like. They always leave me cold. And then secondly, every one that I've looked at on test equipment doesn't look very good. Doesn't look as good as any linear amplifier that's decent. So I'm always cautioned. I'm always cautious about that. I mean, we ran into CD saying that it was the God's gift to audio, and we all know that that's not true. I mean, vinyl still sounds better than CD. Mm-hmm. It's got more bandwidth than CD, and linear amplifiers have way more bandwidth than Class D amplifiers. And I think bandwidth is a key to making good sound.
I can understand that point of view, absolutely. Let's see. I wanted to ask, speaking of audio quality. Oh, I know what it was. Sorry, it took me a minute to think of it. You mentioned that Class D amps didn't necessarily sound that good. And they didn't look that good in measurements. But in the reviews in Stereophile, for example, which is a magazine that's published by the company I work for, very often, and we found this at home theater as well, sometimes the measurement and the experience do not match. That is, sometimes a product may measure well but not sound that great, or vice versa. Have you come across that phenomenon?
Absolutely. I've listened to plenty of products that have, you know, awesome measurements and sound really terrible.
Yes. Why is that? How can that be?
Well, I think a lot of it's done with excessive amounts of feedback, nested feedback and global feedback both. And I think that you can certainly get an amplifier to be very, very low distortion and measure beautifully. But I don't think that's always the best thing for sound. I mean, I think feedback is a great thing for audio amplifiers. I just don't think you should overuse it. And how you use it and where you use it, I think, is extremely important.
Let's make sure everybody understands what feedback is. It's when you take a little bit of the output signal and feed it back into the input of the amp, correct?
Yes, yes.
Now, there are amplifiers that tout that they are zero feedback. Is that a technique you have employed or think
no,
is a good idea?
I have some feedback, and, you know, through experience, I've learned where to put the feedback and where and how much to use. And I think you have to start off with a circuit right off from the beginning that is intrinsically low distortion without feedback. And then adding a little bit of feedback makes it a better circuit. I mean, no feedback from either the drivers or the outputs to the input, you are not always in total control of that output stage. Excuse me. I think a little bit of feedback is an extremely important thing in an amplifier. I think you need it, particularly from the output stage. I've never been able to make an amplifier without feedback that looks very good with complex waveforms. without any without applying any feedback. Mm. Now, I'm not saying it can't be done, and I'm not saying that somebody else hasn't done it, but I've never been able to do it.
Mm-hmm. We got one last question from the chat room. We're getting close to the end of our hour together. Who would you say have inspired you? Who were your inspirations as you designed and created amplifiers and developed your career? For example, Charles Hansen at Air, or who else have you looked to as a good designer that you would like to that inspired you in your work?
Well, I think that way before I started Krell, I mean, Nelson Pass is a brilliant, incredible designer. He's made some absolutely fabulous designs, and he's really a master at the art of building and designing amplifiers and electronic circuits. I think he's one of the people in the industry that has done extremely well and is really generous with his chat rooms and his products. And I think he helps a lot of people understand what audio amplifiers are. I think he's a fabulous designer, and I think that John Curl's a wonderful designer. I think that he's come up with a lot of really brilliant circuits, and he's also a wonderful designer.
Mm-hmm. Nelson Pass has been a guest on this show, and I found him to be a wonderful fellow as well. He seems to be very supportive of the DIY community.
Uh-huh.
Which he supports very strongly and encourages people to build their own stuff. So I agree. He's a very inspirational fellow.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on audio quality these days? With the advent of MP3 and playing on these little earbuds and so on. I know that's not your thing. You're an amplifier guy, but the younger people particularly seem to not be caring that much about high quality audio. Is that your impression?
Well, back in at Krell, I had designed a product called a Kid, which is an iPod based product. And I had this idea that I would run a contest for people to listen to their iPods over this Kid through an expensive audio system. It's meant to be part of a component system. And I did an experiment at a dealer in Florida, and when the people came in, I was giving cash rewards for people with the best mix and the best sound. And the people that came in and plugged their iPod into this dock and listened to it over, I think we're using B&W speakers and Krell amplifiers, some of them were totally enthralled with the fact that their music could sound the way it did. I think they were in shock.
Yeah. And these were even MP3 files that had already been compressed with a lot of information lost from the original source.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was the thing. Some of the recordings on MP3 actually sounded quite good. And some of the mixes were good. And some of the people really were into music, but they were into music with headphones. And I think the dealer wound up selling some product to people who just walked in and have never been into a store and have never been invited into a store. And I mean, somehow we as a group of designers, and I've been doing this a long time, and certainly a number of other companies, we need to figure out how to get these people out of their headphones. I mean, it really is a problem, because a lot of kids that I talk to, and I shouldn't say kids, in their 20s and 20 mid-20s and 30s, they've never listened to a speaker. Yeah. Well, to us, I guess they are.
Yeah.
I'm amazed that they've never heard a system or a good system of any kind.
Mm. So how can we get them to people like that who don't listen on speakers, only listen on headphones? Is there any way you can see to introduce them to the joy and wonder of speakers?
Well, I think maybe one of the things that could be done is to invite the public to the CES show.
Ah, now there's an interesting idea.
I mean, I think there should be a manufacturer's day. I mean, or the day is split, where the show opens at 10, and it's manufacturers only from 10 to 2, and then from 2 to 6, it's consumers. And let them come in and hear the stuff, talk to the people who are making the sound, get some interest in it. Maybe do an iPod contest that's global for the whole show. Somebody's got a really hot mix on their iPod that comes in and plays it over a system, and you know they get a couple of the judges that are actually manufacturers in the group and give them a cash reward. Get them to come in and get them to try it.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the one problem I could foresee is that Las Vegas, anyway, in January, is already totally booked up with hotels. The hotels are totally booked with just manufacturers and attendees. 150,000 people come to that show in January. I can't imagine the influx of a bunch of consumers on top of that. Holy smokes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it could be done. And I also think a lot of consumers get in under assumed names. I mean, it's very easy to get into the consumer show.
The CES show. Yeah, that's true. I'm sure a lot of them, have a relationship with a dealer or something, and they'll just get in on the dealer's name or whatever.
Right. But somehow we have to reach out to these guys that are listening on iPods. I mean, really, the thing that got me to build an iPod product at all was I have a great system at home, and I had some friends that are relatively well-to-do that came over, and the wife's a big iPod nut. She has an iPod in the player on their expensive car, and she wanted to hear what was on the iPod, and I couldn't think of anything to plug it into. I mean, we went over to Best Buy's and bought one of the docks there. It was $79, and I was very worried. I actually brought it in and hooked it up to some test equipment to see what was coming out of it before I hooked it up to my system.
And what did you find?
I just found that it was just normal. There was nothing really wrong with it, and I was worried about DC or RF or who knows what's coming out of it.
Yeah, right.
So I hooked up, checked it, and it was fine. I played it. But it occurred to me that somebody would want to have an iPod dock that meets up with or matches up to their audio system. So if they've got, $40,000, $50,000 invested in an audio system, it doesn't feel right to plug in a $79 iPod dock.
Yeah, understood. Well, speaking of CES, it's right around the corner.
Yes.
And I know you're going to be there, and I'm going to be there. And I'm looking forward to hearing this amp. What speakers are you going to be playing with it?
We're going to be using Wilson Sashes.
Oh, man. That's going to sound amazing, I'll bet.
Yeah, those are awesome.
Yeah, a CD source?
We're going to be using a DCS Puccini and clock.
Oh, my God. Oh, that's going to be amazing.
And we're using the transparent MMF wire all through the system.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of that, give us a moment on expensive exotic cable. How much difference do you think it makes?
Well, if you'd have asked me this question a year ago, I would have said that mostly it makes the system sound worse.
It sounds worse?
Yes. But, I have to say that spending some time when I designed this amplifier, I really wanted to cover all the bases. And I had some time to play around with it, and I must say that what the people at Transparent are doing is extraordinary. I mean, it is expensive, but I think that I was totally flabbergasted at the detail and the musicality of what they're doing. I mean, they clearly have made a contribution to the audio chain that is something that an amplifier designer or a speaker designer can't do. And they've really made something that sounds extraordinary. I mean, I've heard a lot of different cables, and I'm not trying to make this a commercial for Transparent, but
sure,
I must say that after listening to so many things, I find that this is just extraordinary sounding stuff. I got more detail. I've got a wider sound stage. It's more musical. I mean, there's nothing I could say bad against. It's just wonderful sounding.
Well, that's quite remarkable, particularly coming from someone who a year ago or even less might have answered that question very differently and said, yeah, no, expensive cables, they can't really do anything. Trusting your own ears, of course, and really doing the experimentation yourself and finding out that, yes, in fact, they do make a significant improvement is quite a statement.
Yes, I'm surprised that I found that out, because I never believed I guess it was kind of a flat earther. I mean, I never thought that it would make much of a difference. I mean, from an empirical standpoint, when you think about it, I mean, they are making changes in inductive and the amount of inductance and resistance and capacitance, because that's what wire is made up. But I think that some of these people, particularly people in Transparent, have gone a step farther and actually have done what have been done in transmission lines for years. They've actually figured out a type of termination that enhances the audio performance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Got another comment in the chat room about listening to high end at a show like CES or the Stereophile show when it was on, or any of a number of other shows, never sounds that good because you're in the wrong size room. You're in these hotel rooms. How can you possibly sound that good in a hotel room? How do you deal with that?
Well, you don't. You have to live with what you have there. You try to make it the best you can make it, but it's never perfect. Averaging of what the system can do. It's not exactly what it can do, but it's something like what it can do.
Do you bring some acoustic treatments, say, and put them around the room to try and improve
things? I am not for doing that.
Why not?
I believe that. I mean, first of all, I think that it's very difficult to play with acoustic treatment in 1 or 2 days that you have to set up.
Yeah.
I think that your auditory conditioning of your brain takes 3 or 4 days to actually hear what some of this stuff does, and you're trying to do it in a day in a room that you're unfamiliar with. I think you're really maybe making it worse.
Shooting yourself in the foot, in a sense.
Yeah, you could be. I mean, because what you hear is, oh, that sounds a little bit better. But if you had to listen to it for 3 days like that, you might say, gee, I think I want to go back to the other way because I hear some things that I don't like. And I mean, we've all been there with audio equipment and particularly with acoustic treatment.
Yeah. Yeah, that is kind of I mean, there's certainly a lot of science behind it, but there's also some trial and error that takes a while to settle down. So I understand exactly what you're saying there.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm hoping that my room sounds okay. I mean, a lot of people that have used the rooms at the Venetian say they sound okay. I'm sure they're not perfect. I'm sure they have their problems. I don't think I've ever been to one of these shows where the rooms don't have their problems.
Right, sure. And, of course, CES being in January is not the most ideal situation, is it?
No, I think that's a terrible time for a show. I mean, it's the worst possible time for a manufacturer. It's in the middle of his production year. I mean, I shouldn't say that. I mean, it's the beginning of the year, but I mean, people, you know, you've been producing product, and it's in the middle of the selling year. I mean,
right.
you really, it starts from September and kind of ends or kind of slows down in April and May. And then when summer comes, I mean, I personally don't want to sit in the house and listen to audio equipment in July. I mean, you know, I live in New England where I don't have long, wonderful summers. We get 2 months or 3 months and we want to be out in it. And I think a lot of people are like that. I mean, the best time for a show certainly would be in May or June, like we used to have at the Chicago show. January is a terrible time for a manufacturer.
Yeah, I have to mention the CEA line shows. I don't know if you're familiar with that. They have been doing that the last couple of years in June in New York City. Trying to, I guess, jumpstart a summer CES as there used to be in Chicago. And I've always thought it was a great idea. And I wish them all the success in doing that. And I have to agree that jumping out right after New Year's into Vegas and into CES is not my idea of a good time necessarily either. Although I have to say, I don't know how you feel about CES in general. I have always enjoyed myself at CES. Most of my colleagues moan and groan and complain about, oh, CES, Las Vegas, pain in the butt to get around, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, it is that, but it's also so much fun. I mean, do you find time to have fun at these shows, or are you just totally locked in your room?
Well, I think I'm going to be locked in my room for this show. But, you know, I mean, the show closes, you go out to dinner, you're with some people you know, or you're with some friends or prospective distributors or dealers. And you enjoy their company because you get to listen to what they have to say and what mm-hmm. their experiences are and what they think. I mean, I too, like you, have always kind of enjoyed the show as the idea of the show. I've always worked at it. I can't remember the last time I was a spectator.
Right. I've always found that the show, for me, seeing and hearing both the products of video products and audio products is important, but at least as important, and probably more so really to me, is the FaceTime that I get with people from all over the country that I only see at CES and maybe CEDIA in the fall. And so it's the FaceTime that is so important to me, and why one of the reasons I enjoy it. As you say, you get to go out to dinner, you see people, you talk, you find out what they're thinking about and what's important to them and so on.
Well, you know, I completely agree with you, and I think Las Vegas is a wonderful place to have a show. But I would love to see it happen in April or May. I think It would be perfect for manufacturers. I mean, for instance, you know, I'm coming to the show and I'm just getting my first production run of amplifiers built. Now, if I need some parts, I'm running into Christmas, I'm running into New Year's, I can't get them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's silly as a manufacturer, it's punitive to have the show in January.
Yeah, yeah. Not to mention the fact that a lot of manufacturers will introduce a product in January at the CES show, and then you won't see it for sale for months, summer or fall even.
Exactly. I mean, that's a problem. I mean, back in the days when we had the Chicago show, you could show it in June and ship it in September, and it worked out perfectly.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right.
I just wish the show would be like that. And I mean, we're working hard towards getting more people to be aware of when this show is. I mean, the closer to New Year's Day it is, the worse it is for everybody.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And this year it's pretty darn close.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we've run out of time. I want to thank you, Dan D'Agostino, for a wonderful hour of conversation about power amps and such. And I look forward to seeing you in Vegas.
All right. And thank you.
Thanks so much. You can check out Dan's work at his new website, DagostinoInc.com. You can also reach me at my online homes at ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com. You can also email me at scott@twit.tv and follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Ty Roberts, the CTO of Gracenote, a music and video database and technology developer with its fingers in a lot of pies. So it should be a very interesting conversation. Sure hope you'll join me. Until then, geek out.